come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're sitting here in my attic room. It's pretty warm outside, but the curtains are open today. The yard is still looking a little toasted after the August we had. It's hard to believe that we're only a couple of weeks away from autumn. Right now, it's still so very much summer, but only by the calendar date. We're just at the beginning of the school year, which we culturally, ironically, refer to as the fall. My household is far enough into the school year now that we have the beginnings of household routines, though that's still a long way from being settled. A funny thing about being a parent is that back to school is a bizarre kind of flashback. Little memories that I'd misplaced suddenly appear, fully formed. I didn't even need the taste of a madeleine. Just walking up to a school building or packing a backpack is enough to put me there. And sometimes, as an adult, you find different perspectives. When my kids have movie days, I understand now that the movie we watched in class wasn't as much for fun, but to give the teacher a chance to catch up on paperwork. Of course, we did sometimes watch movies for actual academic value, but that was very infrequent. And pretty much always, it was in a history class. Which is to say, I watched a lot of historical epics in school. They came in a whole range of actual historical value, too. We watched Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World as part of our unit on the Napoleonic Wars. And while I don't actually think we spent very much time on Napoleon in that class, like, I still get the timeline of his reign all muddled in my head, that movie is widely regarded as one of the most accurate historical films ever made. We also watched Gladiator, which is to say the actual academic value of these films is definitely up for debate. But a historical film feels valuable. All those grand sets and the horses and the costumes makes each film feel important. That it is saying something genuine about history. There's a gravitas in a period film, especially an epic, and especially a historical war film. But when you watch enough of them, you start to notice some things, especially if you happen to be female. Now, I'm no stranger to what is colloquially referred to as dad cinema. I've talked with you more than once about how I find action films cozy. When I'm having a bad day, there's nothing better than watching a dude beat up another dude in an interesting and inventive way. So, hey, if that dude happens to be wearing a puffy shirt and wielding a musket, I'm all for it. But when a genre is made for men, it does tend to be commonplace that the women in the story can be a bit lackluster, and the romances even more so. Lots of historical epics don't have women at all. Generally, that's fine. I don't need a woman to be thrust into a story just because it's starting to feel like a bit of a sausage fest. But sometimes it does start to feel like maybe there were women they could have featured in this story. Maybe those women are just off screen, over there somewhere. And that's a bummer. Though, frankly, when there are women, they're very often not worth being there at all. You have your damsels in distress. These are the women that are there to be pretty and there to be rescued. There's quite a lot of screaming and wide-eyed looks here. Then there are the dead wives. These often die in the beginning, so they can drive the hero's plot forward. Then there are the hot witnesses. These are beautiful, aloof ladies in pretty dresses who watch the hero do bold things. Sometimes there is unfulfilled longing. Often they sleep together, and then either she dies or he does. On their own, none of these would be particularly egregious. Gender stereotypes in gendered films are quite common. I talked last month about Uptown Girls and didn't devote any time to the mess of a love interest because he's just there to do plot things. His character is all over the place, but that's just a feature of a chick flick. The boy can be kind of an afterthought, especially if he's conventionally attractive. It's not surprising that dad cinema would do the same to women. It just gets exhausting after a while. So when you see a film, do the work to actually make a compelling love interest in a historical war epic, a well-designed romance. It is absolutely worth talking about. Which is why I'd like to discuss Michael Mann's 1992 film, The Last of the Mohicans, and how he designed the romance between Nathaniel and Cora. I use the word design very specifically here, which is pretty interesting under the circumstances. The Last of the Mohicans is an adaptation of a book and a remake of a 1936 film, which took some definite liberties with the source material. Mann's film retains elements from the book and holds on to some changes from the 30s film, but this absolutely isn't a regurgitation. It's its own thing, and Cora is a huge part of that. The Last of the Mohicans was originally published in 1826 by American novelist James Fenimore Cooper. It wasn't intended as a serious account of history. It's what was then called a romance, a genre most easily described as a melodramatic adventure tale set in a theme park version of history. Like, what if the show Outlander was for dudes too? Cooper spent his childhood near Otsego Lake in New York State, in the town that would come to be named after his father, appropriately, Cooperstown. He grew up in the early days of the United States as an actual country, in a region with recent memory of early colonization, when New York State was the frontier. So later, when he decided to try his hand at writing books, he went back to the region of his imagination and spun an adventure set during the French and Indian War. This book is the second entry into what's known as the Leatherstocking Tales, five novels set in the wilderness of the Mohawk Valley featuring the protagonist Natty Bumppo, a frontiersman also known as Hawkeye, probably inspired by some figures Cooper knew from his childhood. In these books, Natty Bumppo is the protagonist in the same way Hercule Poirot is the protagonist of his series. The adventures are happening around him, more than to him, but he joins in to save the day anyway. The plot involves two young women, a Miss Cora and a Miss Alice Monroe, fictional daughters of the very real Colonel Monroe. They are traveling through the wilderness with Major Duncan Hayward to the garrison at Fort William Henry, where their father is the commander, and are led by a traitorous Huron guide called Magua. Their crew runs into Natty Bumppo and his Mohican friends, Chingachgook, and his son Uncas. Magua has a vendetta against the Monroes, and there are various instances of his capturing the young women and threatening them before they're rescued by Natty Bumppo and his Mohican friends, all woven in and around the very real siege of Fort William Henry and the sensationalized account of the massacre of surrendered British by native warriors. If you haven't picked up already, this is a story that comes with no small amount of racial bias, historical misinformation, and what academics call othering, the practice of making a group of people into a separate category of being by removing their personhood. This is actually on kind of a spectrum. On one side, you have the idea of the savage. This is when you remove someone's personhood by making them less than human, a creature, a beast, a monster, which is what happens to the character of Magua. He's a drunkard, violent, traitorous, lecherous, and cruel. On the other side of the spectrum, you have exoticism. This is when you remove someone's personhood by making them more than human, a majestic spiritual being, noble beyond real humans. That's where Uncas lives. He's a calm, chiseled, stoic, powerful Indian warrior. And in this novel, Cooper spends a good deal of time explaining a lot of horrifying racial typology for why Magua's race is degenerate and Uncas's is noble. But of course, neither of them are actual humans, allowed to be both noble and messy, to have agency and flaws and personhood. They are, however, both romantically interested in Cora Monroe. In Cooper's story, Cora and Alice are half-sisters. Alice's mother was British, but Cora's mother was from the West Indies. Cooper uses the term mulatto to describe her, which could mean that she was biracial or that she was of some mixed racial heritage. This leaves Cora ethnically ambiguous, which then, as now, is a perfect recipe for some exoticism. Cora is quiet, calm, intelligent, and brave. She's also dark of hair and has a darker skin tone, so it would make sense why she would be the object of affection for two native men. She is, after all, in the same racial category, the other. Alice is lovely, happy, and blonde. She's the romantic partner to Duncan Hayward, because of course she is. They are cut from the same cloth. It is worth noting that Cora and Alice's father challenges Hayward to having racial bias by picking Alice over Cora. Of course, Hayward denies this, but he's still Alice's guy in the end. Alice is very much a damsel in distress type, pretty and wide-eyed, and the object of rescue. Cora is more of a woman who watches. She is brave and courageous and stalwart. A good match, frankly, for these stoic and noble Uncas. And, spoilers for a 200-year-old novel, when they both die in the final battle against Magua, they are buried together, eulogized in a beautiful, albeit exoticized, ceremony. There's so much time and care put into Cora and her courageous resistance to Magua's advances and her gracious affection towards Uncas. Many people find her story far more compelling than Alice's. Yes, she's part of a trope known as the tragic mulatto, mixed-race women who are offered pathos but must have a sad end as a consequence of being not one thing or the other. But she's more interesting than Alice, who might be plucked from this story and put into a number of similar sorts of books. So here we have Natty Bumppo, Hawkeye, the Scout, as an involved hero. Cora, the tragic, quiet, brave, and ethnically ambiguous older sister with Uncas as her brave, noble, strong warrior romantic interest. And Alice, the pretty, happy, lovely younger sister with Duncan Hayward, the proper, chivalrous, respectful soldier, as her romantic interest. This book is hailed as one of the first great American novels. It's compelling, interesting, rooted in real history and unique culture and place, and a good adventure. So, of course, it gets adapted to film immediately. Like, in 1909, there are at least 11 different film adaptations of this story, but the one that Michael Mann saw as a child, which seared itself into his imagination, was the 1936 version, starring Randolph Scott. This film has quite a few innovations with the story, but it also has a very different perspective on Native Americans. James Fenimore Cooper's novel is a messy racial portrayal, but it does make attempts at authenticity. He got a lot of things wrong, beginning his work by stating that there are really only four different kinds of Native American, of which there are just different dialects and variations of culture, which is patently ridiculous. He majorly contributes to the vanishing Indian myth, that Native Americans are a thing of the distant past, now gone from this land like Tolkien's elves. Hence the title, Last of the Mohicans. In his story, Chingachgook is the last of his people. This is not true. There are still Mohican people to this day. They don't live on their ancestral lands, but there are enough of them to have a reservation in Wisconsin. They're still here. Native people are still here. After all the awful stuff their ancestors went through, the struggles they still face today, they're still here. And while this story contributes to that misinformation, it does actually attempt to capture the variety and difference between Native peoples. Both names Chingachgook and Uncas are actual words from the Lenape language. They're not made up. And there is real, lifelong, genuine friendship between Chingachgook and Hawkeye. Chingachgook is a reoccurring character in the Leatherstocking Tales, and he isn't Tonto. He isn't Hawkeye's sidekick. He's his lifelong friend. They are both men without a family, so they carry on together, and that's beautiful. Which is all undermined by the 1936 film. They decided to fit the story into the genre of the Western. So the Indians are all white people in brown face who talk in stoic monosyllables, in contrast to the eloquent speeches given in the book. The Hurons get to have mohawks, which is an innovation, but Chingachgook and Uncas are in the braids and feathers and deerskins of most Westerns. We have smoke signals, we have words from completely different tribal backgrounds that are lumped in with generic Indians, white people are burned at the stake, not in the original book. It is frustrating. Here, Hawkeye has become the full hero of the story. He is at the heart of the action. He no longer has the silly name Natty Bumpo. He wears a coonskin cap, a la Daniel Boone, to communicate that he is a frontiersman. And he's now in romantic competition. We have five romantic characters, as opposed to the previous four, so there's now a love triangle. Alice, our primary heroine, has been given an upgrade. She's now the dark-haired older sister, and the more courageous one, there to protect the blonde Cora. In this version, she's a wealthy lady who looks down on the scrappy Americans, so she and Hawkeye butt heads. And after all, she's already being wooed, not unwillingly, by Duncan Hayward. Of course, on their adventure, she gives up her offenses to Hawkeye and falls for him, even while Duncan stands in their way. Eventually, of course, Duncan graciously bows out. Hawkeye joins the British Army as a scout, and Alice stays in Albany to keep the home fires burning for him, despite this land not being fit for a girl like her. Cora now gets to be the blonde, bright, pretty, lovely one. So it looks extra bad when Magua wants to take her as his wife. Interestingly enough, the romance between Uncas and Cora is retained, even though the Hays Code, which outlawed interracial romance, was in effect at this time. And while it's no longer the climax of this film, their deaths are given extra dramatic weight. Uncas dies holding Cora's hand. This film has several well-crafted, innovative action sequences. Michael Mann, primarily an action director, was heavily inspired by them. He reportedly started working on a script for this film in 1988, though it didn't get picked up until 1990. I don't have any proof, but I can't help but wonder if Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, itself a historical epic focused on a white man among the Lakota Sioux, had something to do with this film's green light, especially with how Michael Mann chose to portray the varied Native cultures in this film, which is to say, fairly respectfully. Michael Mann and his production team did a ton of research on the various people groups involved in the French and Indian War. They worked painstakingly to dress and arm their Native extras as real people from the varied, distinct groups involved in the story, to give them as much dignity as they could. And in that light, they reimagined Hawkeye as Nathaniel, not a white man taking on the Indians' ways as it suits him, or as a white man living his own way in the wilderness, but as the white son of Chingachgook. It was not uncommon for white settlers to be raised in native societies, whether as captives or foundlings, so this isn't a ridiculous idea. This means Nathaniel really gets to live as a kind of bridge between worlds. He is fully enmeshed in the Mohican culture and language, but he's white, so white people approach him differently. There is mess here. It's a bit of a have your cake and eat it too kind of a situation. The badass romantic action hero is still a white man, and he gets to dress and talk like an Indian. But there is something really cool about the way the Mohicans are portrayed. A family unit. Two sons who love and respect their father and work, play, and fight together. Michael Mann sent them all to a wilderness boot camp where they learned how to live off the land. This is, of course, very up Daniel Day-Lewis's method acting alley, so they all very convincingly hunt and hike and live together. So now we have Nathaniel as this almost superhuman tracker and marksman, all in long hair and genuine leather stockings. Who is his romantic lady going to be? If you give him a damsel in distress, then we're just back to the usual power fantasy. Her weakness makes him look strong. The action will look super cool, but the romance will feel a little overpowered. If you give him a woman who watches, there will be dignity between the two of them, but the ending might seem a little bit ridiculous. Why on earth would Nathaniel choose to leave the wilderness for a civilization where there is no respect for the culture he grew up in? And why would his love interest leave her high tower for the wilderness? Do you just make them not end up together? With the tragic nature of the ending of this story, that seems like too much sadness. How do you make this satisfying? By crafting a female character with an actual arc and actual agency. By granting her personhood. The first thing Michael Mann did was to pick the most interesting character from the book, Cora, and make her Nathaniel's love interest. He kept the whitewashing of the character from the 1936 film, but he keeps her courage and her dignity from the book. He lets sweet, lovely, blonde Alice be the younger sister and the object of Uncas's affection. He also makes Magua more of a human character, with a compelling backstory and a messy but understandable reaction to colonialism. His taking Alice as his bride is set up as his chief's choice of wise judgment instead of a creaturely lust. We are introduced to Cora in the context of her relationship to Duncan Hayward. It's a brief greeting between the two of them. Scene two is when he proposes to her, but instead of making us sit through the proposal that we already know isn't going to go anywhere, of course she's going to end up with the already introduced long-haired, puffy-shirted Nathaniel, the scene cuts right to her refusal and right to her character arc. She's content to be just friends. Duncan argues that friendship is a great start to a romance, which Cora admits other people have said too. Duncan persuades her that she should let other people make her choices for her. And here we have the arc. Cora is going to learn to embrace her own choices and throw off the notion that other people should make decisions for her about her life, which sets up an awesome romance. We've already seen in the beginning of the film that Nathaniel is a man who challenges the British army, who will not let the king who supposedly owns his homeland tell him how to live his life. And now Cora is in motion to join him on that trajectory. During the first ambush of their party by Magua and the Huron, the sisters and Duncan are rescued by Nathaniel and the Mohicans. Duncan raises his gun to shoot Hawkeye, treating him as another bad Indian. Cora yells, "No!" Nathaniel quickly stops him, quipping that Duncan should have listened to the lady. Nathaniel and Cora meet, by him indicating that she is correct and worth listening to. While Nathaniel and the Mohicans collect supplies from the fallen soldiers, Cora picks up a pistol. In the following scene, there's a disagreement between Cora and Nathaniel where their values clash, but shortly after, he does give her an explanation and she listens. They had encountered a frontier family, murdered by a war party, and she's confused as to why they would choose to live in such a dangerous place. "Out here they're beholden to none," Nathaniel says, "not living by another's leave." So Cora's arc is even clearer. In this one scene where Nathaniel explains Mohican myths and the appeal of frontier life, she knows this is where she belongs, where she won't have to let other people make choices for her. When there are enemies, she pulls out her pistol, just as Nathaniel pulls out his long gun, and he doesn't comment on it, or even acknowledge it. Cora is brave, and part of her bravery in this film is to know that there are times when it is necessary to arm herself. Nathaniel isn't bothered by that in the slightest. And that's what stands out to me the most about the design of this couple. They're equals of complete dignity. Nathaniel respects her. And this Cora is the kind to jump in to help the surgeon when they reach the fort, bandaging wounds as if she's done it before, which maybe she has. She does mention at one point that she has seen the face of war before. This Cora has skills. When the two of them consummate their relationship, the scene is wordless, beginning with the two of them in a medium shot, standing tall, heads raised, gazing eye to eye. She is not a damsel. She is not just a witness. She is an active participant, a match in all ways. They are different, from different backgrounds, but they stand as complete equals in the relationship. Later, after the massacre, in the famous scene under the waterfall, pulled straight from Cooper's novel, as the Huron warriors come after them, Nathaniel knows he and the Mohicans must leave to give the women and Duncan the best chance to be captured instead of killed. He and his family come to this decision in their own language, and Cora comes to the same realization. He doesn't have to explain it to her at all. "Yes, go ahead," she yells over the water. They are completely on the same page. And when he tells her that she must stay alive until he finds her, we know it isn't because she's a damsel in need of rescue. It's because she's brave and courageous and strong enough to withstand whatever comes. She even manages to leave him a trail, breaking branches on their path. They are a good match. So when we finally reach the end of the film, while Chingachgook eulogizes the death of Uncas and his people, Nathaniel and Cora at his side, it isn't a complete tragedy. Cora will learn from him, too. She and Nathaniel will live in the wilderness with Chingachgook, a new family unit. Nathaniel doesn't have to be civilized, and Cora doesn't have to bend to the views of others. I fully believe that the Cora who could shoot a man point blank with her pistol is absolutely capable of joining this family, and that she is most herself by doing so. Michael Mann does a lot of work in this film, building out historical context, detail, and facts. While Cooper's novel is only loosely historical, the 1936 film even less so, Mann poured in so much care and context into this story. There is some silliness, but there's a heck of a lot more attention paid than any previous adaptation. Historians can actually stand to watch this film and have quite a bit to say about it. But I love that this film spends an equal amount of care and attention on the central romance, and particularly on Cora. She isn't an afterthought or a prize to be won. She's a person. I wish that more women in historical epics could be that way, so that when high schoolers have a movie day, they're not only treated to an interpretation of history, but to a picture of what a romance of equal dignity and value actually looks like. Thanks for coming.